7. He gets into his Prius, drives to the end of the Zane Aviation turnaround, parks and watches Madden grub the navigator's key out of the grass. He waves as Madden drives past him. Madden doesn't wave back, which doesn't even come close to breaking Hodge's heart. He follows the navigator along the airport feeder road, not quite tailgating, but close. When Madden turns off toward the main terminals, Hodges flashes a so long with his lights. Half a mile farther up, he pulls into the lot of Midwest Air Motive and calls Pete Huntley, his old partner. He gets a civil enough, "Hey, Billy, how you doing?" But nothing you'd call effusive. Since Hodges went his own way in the matter of the so-called Mercedes killer and barely escaped serious legal trouble as a result, his relationship with Pete has frosted over. Maybe this will thaw it out a bit. Certainly he feels no remorse about lying to the moke now heading for the Delta terminal. If ever there was a guy who deserved a heaping spoonful of his own medicine, it's Oliver Madden. "How would you like to bag an extremely tasty turkey, Pete?"
"How tasty?"
Still cool, but on the interested side of cool now. "FBI 10 Most Wanted, that tasty enough? He's currently checking in at Delta, scheduled to leave for L.A. on flight 119 at 1:45 p.m., going under James Mallon, but his real name is Oliver Madden. He stole a bunch of money from the feds 5 years ago as Oliver Mason, and you know how Uncle Sam feels about getting his pocket picked." He adds a few of the more colorful details on Madden's resume. "You know he's at Delta, how?" "Because I bought the ticket. I'm leaving the airport now. I just repoed his plane, which was not his plane because he made the down payment with a rubber check. Holly will call Zane Aviation and give them all the details. She loves that part of the job." A long moment of silence. Then,
"Aren't you ever going to retire, Billy?"
"That sort of hurts." "You could say thanks, it wouldn't kill you." Pete sighs. "I'll call airport security and get on out there myself." A pause. Then, "Thank you, Kermit." Hodges grins. It's not much, but it might be a start in repairing what has been, if not broken, then badly sprained. "Thank Holly. She's the one who tracked him down. She's still jumpy with people she doesn't know, but when she's on the computer, she kills."
"I'll be sure to do that."
"And say hi to Izzy." Isabel Janes has been Pete's partner since Hodges pulled the pin. She's one dynamite redhead and plenty smart. It occurs to Hodges, almost as a shock, that soon enough she'll be working with a new partner. Pete himself will be retiring ere long.
"I'll pass that on, too. Want to give me this guy's description for the airport security guys?"
"He's hard to miss. 6.5 feet tall, light brown suit, probably looking a little woozy just about now."
"You clocked him?"
"I soothed him." Pete laughs. It's good to hear him do that. Hodges ends the call and heads back to the city, well on the way to being $20,000 richer, courtesy of a crusty old Texan named Dwight Cram. He'll call and give Cram the good news after he finds out what the Barbster wants. 8. Drew Halliday, Drew is what he prefers to be called now among his small circle of friends, eats eggs Benedict at his usual corner table in Jamais, toujours. He ingests slowly, pacing himself, although he could gobble everything in 4 large gulps, then pick up the plate and lick the tasty yellow sauce like a dog licking its bowl. He has no close relatives. His love life has been in the rearview mirror for over 15 years now, and face it, his small circle of friends are really no more than acquaintances. The only things he cares about these days are books and food. Well, no. These days, there's a third thing. John Rothstein's notebooks have made a reappearance in his life. The waiter, a young fellow in a white shirt and tight black pants, glides over. Longish dark blonde hair, clean and tied back at the nape so his elegant cheekbones show. Drew has been in a little theater group for 30 years now. Funny how time glides away. Only not really. And he thinks William would make a perfectly adequate Romeo, always assuming he could act. And good waiters always can, a little. "Will there be anything else, Mr. Halliday?" "Yes," he thinks, two more of these, followed by two creme brulees and a strawberry shortcake.
Another cup of coffee, I think.
William smiles, exposing teeth that have received nothing but the best of dental care.
I'll be back with it in two shakes of a lamb's tail.
Drew pushes his plate away regretfully, leaving the last smear of yolk and hollandaise behind.
He takes out his appointment book. It's a moleskin, of course, the pocket-sized one. He pages past 4 months' worth of jottings, addresses, reminders to self, prices of books he's ordered or will order for various clients. Near the end, on a blank page all its own, are two names. The first is James Hawkins. He wonders if it's a coincidence or if the boy picked it deliberately. Do boys still read Robert Louis Stevenson these days? Drew tends to think this one did. After all, he claims to be a lit major, and Jim Hawkins is the hero narrator of Treasure Island. The name written below James Hawkins is Peter Saubers. 9. Saubers, a.k.a. Hawkins, came into the shop for the first time 2 weeks ago, hiding behind a ridiculous adolescent mustache that hadn't had a chance to grow out much. He was wearing black horn rims like the ones Drew, then Andy, affected back in the days when Jimmy Carter was president. Teenagers did not, as a rule, come into the shop, and that was fine with Drew. He might still be attracted to the occasional young male, William the waiter being a case in point. But teens tended to be careless with valuable books, handling them roughly, reshelving them upside down, even dropping them. Also, they had a regrettable tendency to shoplift. This one looked as if he would turn and sprint for the door if Drew so much as said boo. He was wearing a City College jacket, although the day was too warm for it. Drew, who'd read his share of Sherlock Holmes, put it together with the mustache and studious horn rims and deduced that here was a lad attempting to look older, as if he were trying to get into one of the dance clubs downtown instead of a bookshop specializing in rare volumes. "You want me to take you for at least 21, Drew thought, "but if you're a day past 17, I'll eat my hat. You're not here to browse either, are you? I believe you are a young man on a mission." Under his arm, the boy carried a large book in a manila envelope. Drew's first thought was that the kid wanted an appraisal on some moldy old thing he'd found in the attic, but as Mr. Mustache drew hesitantly closer, Drew saw a purple sticker he recognized at once on the spine of the book. Drew's first impulse was to say, "Hello, son," but he quashed it. Let the kid have his college boy disguise. What harm? "Good afternoon, sir. May I help you?"
For a moment, young Mr. Mustache said nothing. The dark brown of his new facial hair was in stark contrast to the pallor of his cheeks.
Drew realized he was deciding whether to stay or mutter, "Guess not," and get the hell out. One word would probably be enough to turn him around, but Drew suffered the not unusual antiquarian disease of curiosity. So he favored the boy with his most pleasant wouldn't-hurt-a-fly smile, folded his hands, and kept silent.
"Well," the boy said at length, "maybe."
Drew raised his eyebrows.
"You buy rarities as well as sell them, right? That's what your website says?"
"I do. If I feel I can sell them at a profit, that is. It's the nature of the business." The boy gathered his courage. Drew could almost see him doing it, and stepped all the way up to the desk, where the circular glow of an old-fashioned angle-poised lamp spotlighted a semi-organized clutter of paperwork. Drew held out his hand. "Andrew Halliday." The boy shook it briefly and then withdrew as if fearful of being grabbed.
"I'm James Hawkins."
"Pleased to meet you."
"Uh-huh. I think I have something you might be interested in, something a collector might pay a lot for, if it was the right collector."
"Not the book you're carrying, is it?"
Drew could see the title now, "Dispatches from Olympus."
The subtitle wasn't on the spine, but Drew had owned a copy for many years and knew it well. Letters from 20 great American writers in their own hand.
Gosh, no, not this one. James Hawkins gave a small, nervous laugh. This is just for comparison.
Very well. Say on.
For a moment, James Hawkins seemed unsure how to do that. Then he tucked his manila envelope more firmly under his arm and began to hurry through the glossy pages of dispatches from Olympus, passing a note from Faulkner scolding an Oxford, Mississippi feed company about a misplaced order, a gushy letter from Eudora Welty to Ernest Hemingway, a scrawl about who knew what from Sherwood Anderson, and a grocery list Robert Penn Warren had decorated with a doodle of two dancing penguins, one of them smoking a cigarette. At last he found what he wanted, set the book on the desk, and turned it to face Drew.
Here, he said, look at this.
Drew's heart jumped as he read the heading. John Rothstein to Flannery O'Connor. The carefully photographed note had been written on lined paper tattered down the left-hand side where it had been torn from a dime store notebook. Rothstein's small, neat handwriting, very unlike the scrawl of so many writers, was unmistakable. February 19, 1953. My dear Flannery O'Connor, I am in receipt of your wonderful novel, Wise Blood, which you have so kindly inscribed to me. I can say wonderful because I purchased a copy as soon as it came out and read it immediately. I am delighted to have a signed copy, as I am sure you are delighted to have the royalty accruing from one more sold volume. I enjoyed the entire motley cast of characters, especially Hazel Motes and Enoch Emery, a zookeeper I'm sure my own Jimmy Gold would have enjoyed and befriended. You have been called a connoisseur of grotesqueries, Miss O'Connor, yet what the critics miss, probably because they have none themselves, is your lunatic sense of humor, which takes no prisoners. I know you are physically unwell, but I hope you will persevere in your work in spite of that. It is important work. Thanking you again, John Rothstein. P.S. I still laugh about the famous chicken. Drew scanned the letter longer than necessary to calm himself and looked up at the boy calling himself James Hawkins.
Do you understand the reference to the famous chicken? I'll explain if you like. It's a good example of what Rothstein called her lunatic sense of humor.
I looked it up. When Miss O'Connor was 6 or 7, she had, or claimed she had, a chicken that walked backwards.
Some newsreel people came and filmed it, and the chicken was in the movies. She said it was the high point of her life, and everything afterwards was an anticlimax.
Exactly right.
Now that we've covered the famous chicken, what can I do for you?
The boy took a deep breath and opened the clasp on his manila envelope.
From inside, he took a photocopy and laid it beside Rothstein's letter and dispatches from Olympus. Drew Halliday's face remained placidly interested as he looked from one to the other, but beneath the desk, his fingers interlaced so tightly that his closely clipped nails dug into the backs of his hands. He knew what he was looking at immediately. The squiggles on the tails of the Y's. The B's that always stood by themselves. The H's that stood high and the G's that dipped low. The question now was how much James Hawkins knew. Maybe not a lot, but almost certainly more than a little. Otherwise he would not be hiding behind a new mustache and specs looking suspiciously like the clear glass kind that could be purchased in a drugstore or a costume shop. At the top of the page circled was the number 44. Below it was a fragment of poetry.
Suicide is circular, or so I think. You may have your own opinion. In the meantime, meditate on this. A plaza just after sunrise. You could say in Mexico, or Guatemala if you like. Any place where the rooms still come with wooden ceiling fans. In any case, it's blanco up to the blue sky except for the ragged mops of palms and rosa where the boy outside the cafe is washing cobbles half asleep. On the corner, waiting for the first. It ended there. Drew looked up at the boy.
It goes on about the first bus of the day, James Hawkins said, the kind that runs on wires. A trolley bus, he calls it. It's Spanish for trolley. The wife of the man narrating the poem, or maybe it's his girlfriend, is sitting dead in the corner of the room. She shot herself. He's just found her.
It doesn't strike me as deathless poesy, Drew said. In his current gobsmacked state, it was all he could think of to say. Regardless of its quality, the poem was the first new work by John Rothstein to appear in over half a century. No one had seen it but the author, this boy, and Drew himself. Unless Morris Bellamy had happened to glimpse it, which seemed unlikely given the great number of notebooks he claimed to have stolen. The great number. My God, the great number of notebooks.
No, it's sure not Wilfred Owen or T.S. Eliot, but I don't think that's the point, do you?
Drew was suddenly aware that James Hawkins was watching him closely. And seeing what? Probably too much.
Drew was used to playing them close to the vest. You had to in a business where lowballing the seller was as important as highballing potential buyers.
But this was like the Titanic, suddenly floating to the surface of the Atlantic Ocean, dinged up and rusty, but there.
Okay, then. Admit it.
No, probably not.
The photocopy and the letter to O'Connor were still side by side, and Drew couldn't help moving his pudgy finger back and forth between points of comparison. If it's a forgery, it's a damned good one.
It's not.
No lack of confidence there. Where did you get it?
The boy then launched into a bullshit story Drew barely listened to, something about how his Uncle Phil in Cleveland had died and willed his book collection to young James, and there had been 6 moleskin notebooks packed in with the paperbacks and Book of the Month Club volumes, and it turned out, heidi-ho, that these 6 notebooks, filled with all sorts of interesting stuff, mostly poetry along with some essays and a few fragmentary short stories, were the work of John Rothstein.
How did you know it was Rothstein?
I recognized his style even in the poems, Hawkins said. It was a question he had prepared for, obviously. I'm majoring in American Lit at CC, and I've read most of his stuff. But there's more. For instance, this one is about Mexico, and Rothstein spent 6 months wandering around there after he got out of the service.
Along with a dozen other American writers of note, including Ernest Hemingway and the mysterious B. Traven.
Yeah, but look at this.
The boy drew a second photocopy from his envelope.
Drew told himself not to reach for it greedily, and reached for it greedily.
He was behaving as though he'd been in this business for 3 years instead of over 30, but who could blame him?
This was big. This was huge. The difficulty was that James Hawkins seemed to know it was.
Ah, but he doesn't know what I know, which includes where they came from. Unless Maury is using him as a cat's paw. And how likely is that with Maury rotting in Waynesville State Prison?
The writing on the second photocopy was clearly from the same hand, but not as neat. There had been no scratch-outs and marginal notes on the fragment of poetry, but there were plenty here.
I think he might have written it while he was drunk, the boy said. He drank a lot, you know, then quit. Cold turkey. Read it, you'll see what it's about.
The circled number at the top of this page was 77. The writing below it started in mid-sentence.
Never anticipated.
While good reviews are always sweet desserts in the short term, one finds they lead to indigestion, insomnia, nightmares, even problems taking that ever more important afternoon shit in the long term. And the stupidity is even more remarkable in the good notices than in the bad ones. To see Jimmy Gold as some sort of benchmark, a hero, even, it's like calling someone like Billy the Kid or Charles Starkweather, his closest 20th century avatar, an American icon. Jimmy is as Jimmy is, even as I am or you are. He is modeled not on Huck Finn, but Etienne Lantier, the greatest character in 19th century fiction. If I have withdrawn from the public eye, it is because that eye is infected and there's no reason to put more material before it. As Jimmy himself would say, shit, don't.
It ended there. But Drew knew what came next, and he was sure Hawkins did too.
It was Jimmy's famous motto, still sometimes seen on t-shirts all these years later. He misspelled stupidity. It was all Drew could think of to say. Uh-huh. And material. Real mistakes, not cleaned up by some copy editor. The boy's eyes glowed. It was a glow Drew had seen often, but never in one so young. It's alive, that's what I think. Alive and breathing. You see what he says about Etienne Lantier? That's the main character of Germinal by Emile Zola, and it's new. Do you get it? It's a new insight into a character everybody knows and from the author himself. I bet some collectors would pay big bucks for the original of this and all the rest of the stuff I have.
You say there are 6 notebooks in your possession?
Uh-huh.
6, not 100 or more. If 6 was all the kid had, then he certainly wasn't acting on Bellamy's behalf unless Morris had for some reason split his haul up. Drew couldn't see his old pal doing that.
They're the medium-sized ones, 80 pages in each. That's 480 pages. A lot of white space, with poems there always is, but they're not all poems. There are those short stories, too. One is about Jimmy Gold as a kid.
But here was a question. Did he, Drew, really believe there were only 6? Was it possible the boy was holding back the good stuff? And if so, was he holding back because he wanted to sell the rest later, or because he didn't want to sell it at all? To Drew, the glow in his eyes suggested the latter, although the boy might not yet know it consciously.
Sir? Mr. Halliday?
Sorry, just getting used to the idea that this really might be new Rothstein material.
It is, the boy said. There was no doubt in his voice. So how much?
How much would I pay? Drew thought Sun would be okay now because they were about to get down to the dickering.
Son, I'm not exactly made of money,
nor am I completely convinced these aren't forgeries, a hoax. I'd have to see the real items. Drew could see Hawkins biting his lip behind the nascent mustache.
I wasn't talking about how much you'd pay. I was talking about private collectors. You must know some who are willing to spend big money for special items.
I know a couple, yes.
He knew a dozen.
But I wouldn't even write to them on the basis of 2 photocopied pages. As for getting authentication from a handwriting expert, that might be dicey. Rothstein was murdered, you know, which makes these stolen property.
Not if he gave them to someone before he was killed, the boy countered swiftly,
and Drew had to remind himself again that the kid had prepared for this encounter. But I have experience on my side, he thought. Experience. And craft. Son, there's no way to prove that's what happened.
There's no way to prove it wasn't either.
So, impasse.
Suddenly, the boy grabbed the 2 photocopies and jammed them back into the manila envelope.
Wait a minute, Drew said, alarmed.
Whoa, hold on. No, I think it was a mistake coming here. There's a place in Kansas City, Jarrett's Fine Firsts and Rare Editions. They're one of the biggest in the country. I'll try there.
If you can hold off a week, I'll make some calls, Drew said. But you have to leave the photocopies.
The boy hovered, unsure. At last he said, How much could you get, do you think?
For almost 500 pages of unpublished, hell, unseen, Rothstein material? The buyer would probably want at least a computer handwriting analysis. There are a couple of good programs that do that, but assuming that proved out, perhaps...
He calculated the lowest possible figure he could throw out without sounding absurd.
Perhaps $50,000.
James Hawkins either accepted this or seemed to. And what would your commission be?
Drew laughed politely. Son, James... No dealer would take a commission on a deal like this one. Not when the creator, known as the proprietor in legalese, was murdered and the material might have been stolen. We'd split right down the middle.
No, the boy said it at once.
He might not yet be able to grow the biker mustache he saw in his dreams, but he had balls as well as smarts.
70-30, my favor.
Drew could give in on this. Get maybe $250,000 for the 6 notebooks and give the boy 70% of $50,000, But wouldn't James Hawkins expect him to dicker, at least a little? Wouldn't he be suspicious if he didn't?
60-40, my last offer, and of course contingent on finding a buyer. That would be $30,000 for something you found crammed into a cardboard box along with old copies of Jaws and the bridges of Madison County. Not a bad return, I'd say.
The boy shifted from foot to foot, saying nothing but clearly conflicted. Drew reverted to the wouldn't-hurt-a-fly smile.
Leave the photocopies with me. Come back in a week and I'll tell you how we stand. Here's some advice. Stay away from Jarrett's place. The man will pick your pockets.
I'd want cash.
Drew thought, don't we all? You're getting way ahead of yourself, son.
The boy came to a decision and put the manila envelope down on the cluttered desk.
Okay, I'll come back.
Drew thought, I'm sure you will, and I believe my bargaining position will be much stronger when you do. He held out his hand. The boy shook it again, as briefly as he could while still being polite, as if he were afraid of leaving fingerprints, which in a way he had already done.
Drew sat where he was until Hawkins went out, then dropped into his office chair. It gave a resigned groan and woke up his sleeping Macintosh. There were two security cameras mounted above the front door, one pointing each way along Lacemaker Lane. He watched the kid turn the corner onto Crossway Avenue and disappear from sight. The purple sticker on the spine of Dispatches from Olympus, that was the key. It marked the volume as a library book, and Drew knew every branch in the city. Purple meant a reference volume from the Garner Street Library, and reference volumes weren't supposed to circulate. If the kid had tried to smuggle it out under his City College jacket, the security gate would have buzzed when he went through, because that purple sticker was also an anti-theft device. Which led to another Holmesian deduction, once you added in the kid's obvious book smarts. Drew went to the Garner Street Library's website, where all sorts of choices were displayed. Summer hours, kids and teens, upcoming events, classic film series, and last, but far from least, meet our staff. Drew Halliday clicked on this and needed to click no farther, at least to begin with. Above the thumbnail bios was a photo of the staff, roughly 24 in all, gathered on the library lawn. The statue of Horace Garner, open book in hand, loomed behind them. They were all smiles, including his boy, sans mustache and bogus spectacles. Second row, third from the left. According to the bio, young Mr. Peter Saubers was a student at Northfield High, currently working part-time. He hoped to major in English, with a minor in library science. Drew continued his researches, aided by the fairly unusual surname. He was sweating lightly, and why not? Six notebooks already seemed like a pittance, a tease. All of them. Some containing a fourth Jimmy Gold novel, if his psycho friend had been right all those years ago, might be worth as much as $50 million. If they were broken up and sold to different collectors. The fourth Jimmy Gold alone might fetch 20, and with Maury Bellamy safely tucked away in prison, all that stood in his way was one teenage boy who couldn't even grow a proper mustache.
10.
William, the waiter, returns with Drew's check, and Drew tucks his American Express card into the leather folder. It will not be refused, he's confident of that. He's less sure about the other two cards, but he keeps the Amex relatively clean because it's the one he uses in business transactions. Business hasn't been so good over the last few years, although God knew it should have been. It should have been terrific, especially between 2008 and 2012 when the American economy fell into a sinkhole and couldn't seem to climb back out. In such times, the value of precious commodities, real things, as opposed to computer boops and bytes on the New York Stock Exchange, always went up. Gold and diamonds, yes, but also art, antiques, and rare books. Fucking Michael Jarrett in KC is now driving a Porsche. Drew has seen it on his Facebook page. His thoughts turned to his second meeting with Peter Saubers. He wishes the kid hadn't found out about the third mortgage. That had been a turning point, maybe the turning point.
Drew's financial woes go back to that damn James Agee book, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. Gorgeous copy, mint condition, signed by Agee and Walker Evans, the man who'd taken the photographs. How was Drew supposed to know it had been stolen? All right, he probably did know. Certainly all the red flags were there and flying briskly, and he should have steered clear, but the seller had had no idea of the volume's actual worth, and Drew had let down his guard a little. Not enough to get fined or thrown in jail, and thank Christ for that, but the results have been long-term. Ever since 1999, he's carried a certain aroma with him to every convention, symposium, and book auction. Reputable dealers and buyers tend to give him a miss unless, here is the irony, they've got something just a teensy bit sketchy they'd like to turn over for a quick profit. Sometimes, when he can't sleep, Drew thinks, they are pushing me to the dark side. It's not my fault. Really, I'm the victim here. All of which makes Peter Saubers even more important. William comes back with the leather folder, face solemn. Drew doesn't like that. Maybe the card has been refused after all. Then his favorite waiter smiles, and Drew releases the breath he's been holding in a soft sigh. Thanks, Mr. Halliday. Always great to see you. Likewise, William. Likewise, I'm sure. He sighs with a flourish and slides his Amex, a bit bowed but not broken, back into his wallet. On the street, walking toward his shop, the thought that he might be waddling never crosses his mind. His thoughts turn to the boy's second visit, which went fairly well, but not nearly as well as Drew had hoped and expected. At their first meeting, the boy had been so uneasy that Drew worried he might be tempted to destroy the priceless trove of manuscript he'd stumbled across. But the glow in his eyes had argued against that, especially when he talked about that second photocopy, with its drunken ramblings about the critics. "It's alive," Saubers had said. "That's what I think." "And can the boy kill it?" Drew asks himself as he enters his shop and turns the sign from closed to open. "I don't think so. Any more than he could let the authorities take all that treasure away, despite his threats." Tomorrow is Friday. The boy has promised to come in immediately after school so they can conclude their business. The boy thinks it will be a negotiating session. He thinks he's still holding some cards. Perhaps he is, but Drew's are higher. The light on his answering machine is blinking. It's probably someone wanting to sell him insurance or an extended warranty on his little car. The idea of Jarrett driving a Porsche around Kansas City pinches momentarily at his ego, but you can never tell until you check. Millions are within his reach, but until they are actually in his grasp, it's business as usual. Drew goes to see who called while he was having his lunch and recognizes Sauber's voice from the first word. His fists clench as he listens. 11. When the artist, formerly known as Hawkins, came in on the Friday following his first visit, the mustache was a trifle fuller, but his step was just as tentative. A shy animal approaching a bit of tasty bait. By then, Drew had learned a great deal about him and his family, and about the notebook pages, those two. Three different computer apps had confirmed that the letter to Flannery O'Connor and the writing on the photocopies were the work of the same man. Two of these apps compared handwriting. The third, not entirely reliable given the small size of the scanned-in samples, pointed out certain stylistic similarities, most of which the boy had already seen. These results were tools laid by for the time when Drew would approach prospective buyers. He himself had no doubts, having seen one of the notebooks with his own eyes 36 years ago on a table outside the Happy Cup. "Hello," Drew said. This time he didn't offer to shake hands.
"Hi."
"You didn't bring the notebooks."
"I need a number from you first. You said you'd make some calls."
Drew had made none. It was still far too early for that. "If you recall, I gave you a number. I said your end would come to $30,000.
The boy shook his head.
"That's not enough, and 60-40 isn't enough either. It would have to be 70-30. I'm not stupid. I know what I have."
"I know things, too.
Your real name is Peter Saubers. You don't go to City College. You go to Northfield High and work part-time at the Garner Street Library.
The boy's eyes widened.
His mouth fell open. He actually swayed on his feet, and for a moment Drew thought he might faint.
How?
The book you brought. Dispatches from Olympus. I recognized the reference room security sticker. After that, it was easy. I even know where you live, on Sycamore Street.
Which made perfect, even divine sense. Morris Bellamy had lived on Sycamore Street in the same house. Drew had never been there, because Morris didn't want him to meet his vampire of a mother, Drew suspected. But city records proved it. Had the notebooks been hidden behind a wall in the basement, or buried beneath the floor of the garage? Drew was betting it was one or the other.
He leaned forward as his paunch would allow, and engaged the boy's dismayed eyes. Here's some more. Your father was seriously injured in the city center massacre back in 09. He was there because he became unemployed after the downturn in 08. There was a feature story in the Sunday paper a couple of years ago about how some of the people who survived were doing. I looked it up, and it made for interesting reading. Your family moved to the north side after your father got hurt, which must have been a considerable come-down, but you Sauberses landed on your feet. A nip here and a tuck there with just your mom working, but plenty of people did worse. American success story. Get knocked down, arise, brush yourself off, and get back in the race. Except the story never really said how your family managed that, did it?
The boy wet his lips, tried to speak, couldn't, cleared his throat, tried again.
I'm leaving. Coming here was a big mistake. He turned away from the desk. Peter, if you walk out that door, I can just about guarantee you'll be in jail by tonight. What a shame that would be, with your whole life ahead of you.
Saubers turned back, eyes wide, mouth open and trembling.
I researched the Rothstein killing, too. The police believe that the thieves who murdered him only took the notebooks because they were in his safe along with his money. According to the theory, they broke in for what thieves usually break in for, which is cash. Plenty of people in the town where he lived knew the old guy kept cash in the house, maybe a lot of it. Those stories circulated in Talbot Corners for years. Finally, the wrong someones decided to find out if the stories were true. And they were, weren't they?
Saubers returned to the desk, slowly, step by step.
You found his stolen notebooks, but you also found some stolen money, that's what I think. Enough to keep your family solvent until your dad could get back on his feet again. Literally on his feet, because the story said he was busted up quite badly. Do your folks know, Peter? Are they in on it? Did Mom and Dad send you here to sell the notebooks now that the money's gone? Most of this was guesswork. If Morris had said anything about money that day outside the Happy Cup, Drew couldn't remember it, but he observed each of his guesses hit home like hard punches to the face and midsection. Drew felt any detective's delight in seeing he had followed a true trail. I don't know what you're talking about. The boy sounded more like a phone answering machine than a human being. And as for there only being six notebooks, that really doesn't compute. Rothstein went dark in 1960 after publishing his last short story in The New Yorker. He was murdered in 1978. Hard to believe he only filled 6 80-page notebooks in 18 years. I bet there were more. A lot more.
You can't prove anything.
Still in that same robotic monotone. Saubers was teetering. Two or three more punches and he'd fall. It was rather thrilling. What would the police find if they came to your house with a search warrant, my young friend? Instead of falling, Saubers pulled himself together. If it hadn't been so annoying, it would have been admirable. What about you, Mr. Halliday? You've already been in trouble once about selling what wasn't yours to sell. Okay, that was a hit, but only a glancing blow. Drew nodded cheerfully. It's why you came to me, isn't it? You found out about the AG business and thought I might help you do something illegal. Only my hands were clean then and they're clean now. He spread them to demonstrate. I'd say I took some time to make sure that what you were trying to sell was the real deal, and once I was, I did my civic duty and called the police.
But that's not true. It's not, and you know it.
Welcome to the real world, Peter, Drew thought. He said nothing, just let the kid explore the box he was in.
I could burn them.
Saubers seemed to be speaking to himself rather than Drew, trying the idea on for size.
I could go to where they are and just burn them.
How many are there?
80? 120? 140?
They'd find residue, son. The ashes. Even if they didn't, I have the photocopied pages. They'd start asking questions about just how your family did manage to get through the big recession as well as it did, especially with your father's injuries and all the medical bills. I think a competent accountant might find that your family's outlay extended its income by quite a bit.
Drew had no idea if this was true, but the kid didn't either. He was close to panic now, and that was good. Panicked people never thought clearly. There's no proof.
Saubers could hardly talk above a whisper.
The money is gone.
I'm sure it is, or you wouldn't be here. But the financial trail remains. And who will follow it besides the police?
The IRS.
Who knows, Peter? Maybe your mother and dad can also go to jail for tax evasion. That would leave your sister, Tina, I believe, all alone. But perhaps she has a kind old auntie she can live with until your folks get out.
What do you want?
Don't be dense. I want the notebooks.
All of them.
If I give them to you, what do I get?
The knowledge that you're free and clear, which, given your situation, is priceless. Are you serious?
Son,
don't call me that!
The boy clenched his fists.
Peter, think it through.
If you refuse to turn the notebooks over to me, I'm going to turn you over to the police. But once you hand them over, my hold on you vanishes because I have received stolen property. You'll be safe.
While he spoke, Drew's right index finger hovered near the silent alarm button beneath his desk. Pushing it was the last thing in the world he wanted to do, but he didn't like those clenched fists. In his panic, it might occur to Saubers that there was one other way to shut Drew Halliday's mouth. They were currently being recorded on security video, but the boy might not have realized that.
And you walk away with hundreds and thousands of dollars, Saubers said bitterly. Maybe even millions.
You've got your family through a tough time, Drew said. He thought of adding, why be greedy? But under the circumstances, that might sound a little off.
I think you should be content with that.
The boy's face offered a wordless reply. Easy for you to say.
I need time to think.
Drew nodded, but not in agreement. I understand how you feel, but no. If you walk out of here now, I can promise a police car waiting for you when you get home.
And you lose your big payday.
Drew shrugged.
It wouldn't be the first.
Although never one of this size, that was true.
My dad's in real estate, did you know that?
The sudden change in direction put Drew off his stride a bit.
Yes, I saw that when I was doing my research. Has his own little business now, and good for him. Although I have an idea that John Rothstein's money might have paid for some of the startup costs.
I asked him to research all the bookstores in town, Sauber said. I told him I was doing a paper on how e-books are impacting traditional bookstores. This was before I even came to see you, while I was still making up my mind if I should take the chance. He found out you took a third mortgage on this place last year and said you only got it because of the location, Lacemaker Lane being pretty upscale and all.
I don't think that has anything to do with the subject under discussion.
You're right. We went through a really bad time, and you know something? That gives a person a nose for people who are in trouble. Even if you're a kid, maybe especially if you're a kid, I think you're pretty strapped yourself.
Drew raised the finger that had been poised near the silent alarm button and pointed it at Saubers.
Don't fuck with me, kid.
Saubers' color had come back in big, hectic patches, and Drew saw something he didn't like and certainly hadn't intended.
He had made the boy angry.
I know you're trying to rush me into this, and it's not going to work.
Yes, okay, I've got his notebooks. There's 165. Not all of them are full, but most of them are. And guess what? It was never the Gold Trilogy. It was the Gold Cycle. There are two more novels, both in the notebooks. First drafts, yeah, but pretty clean.
The boy was talking faster and faster, figuring out everything Drew had hoped he would be too frightened to see even as he was speaking.
They're hidden away, but I guess you're right. If you call the police, they'll find them. Only my parents never knew, and I think the police will believe that. As for me, I'm still a minor.
He even smiled a little, as if just realizing this.
They won't do much to me, since I never stole the notebooks or the money in the first place. I wasn't even born. You'll come out clean, but you also won't have anything to show for it. When the bank takes this place, my dad says they will sooner or later, and there's an old bomb pan here instead, I'll come in and eat a croissant in your honor.
That's quite a speech, Drew said.
Well, it's over. I'm leaving.
I warn you, you're being very foolish.
I told you I need time to think.
How long?
A week. You need to think too, Mr. Halliday. Maybe we can still work something out.
I hope so, son. Drew used the word deliberately. Because if we can't, I'll make that call. I am not bluffing. The boy's bravado collapsed, his eyes filled with tears. Before they could fall, he turned and walked down.
12.
Now comes this voicemail, which Drew listens to with fury, but also with fear, because the boy sounds so cold and composed on top and so desperate underneath.
I can't come tomorrow like I said I would. I completely forgot the junior-senior retreat for class officers, and I got elected vice president of the senior class next year. I know that sounds like an excuse, but it's not. I guess it entirely slipped my mind, what with you threatening to send me to jail and all.
Erase this right away, Drew thinks, his fingernails biting into his palms.
It's at Riverbend Resort up in Victor County. We leave on a bus at 8 tomorrow morning. It's a teacher in service day, so there's no school, and come back Sunday night. 20 of us. I thought about begging off, but my parents are already worried about me. My sister, too. If I skip the retreat, they'll know something's wrong. I think my mom thinks I might have gotten some girl pregnant.
The boy voices a brief, semi-hysterical laugh. Drew thinks there's nothing more terrifying than boys of 17. You have absolutely no idea what they'll do.
I'll come on Monday afternoon instead, Saubers resumes. If you wait that long, maybe we can work something out. A compromise. I've got an idea. And if you think I'm just shining you on about the retreat, call the resort and check the reservation. Northfield High School Student Government. Maybe I'll see you on Monday. If not, good but
that's where the message time, extra long for clients who call after hours, usually from the West Coast, finally runs out. Beep. Drew sits down in his chair, ignoring its despairing squeal, as always, and stares at the answering machine for nearly a full minute. He feels no need to call the Riverbend Resort, which is, amusingly enough, only 6 or 7 miles upriver from the penitentiary where the original notebook thief is now serving a life sentence. Drew is sure Saubers was telling the truth about the retreat because it's so easy to check. About his reasons for not ditching it, he's far less sure. Maybe Saubers has decided to call Drew's bluff about bringing the police into it. Except it's not a bluff. He has no intention of letting Saubers have what Drew can't have himself. One way or another, the little bastard is going to give those notebooks up. I'll wait until Monday afternoon, Drew thinks. I can afford to wait that long, but then this situation is going to be resolved one way or the other. I've already given him too much rope. He reflects that the Saubers boy and his old friend Morris Bellamy, although at opposite ends of the age spectrum, are very much alike when it comes to the Rothstein notebooks. They lust for what's inside them. It's why the boy only wanted to sell him 6, and probably the 6 he judged least interesting. Drew, on the other hand, cares little about John Rothstein. He read The Runner, but only because Maury was bonkers on the subject. He never bothered with the other two or the Book of Short Stories.
That's your Achilles heel, son, Drew thinks. That collector's lust. While I, on the other hand, only care about money, and money simplifies everything. So go ahead. Enjoy your weekend of pretend politics. When you come back, we'll play some hardball. Drew leans over his paunch and erases the message. 13. Hodges gets a good whiff of himself on his way back into the city and decides to divert to his house long enough for a veggie burger and a quick shower. Also a change of clothes. Harper Road isn't much out of his way, and he'll be more comfortable in a pair of jeans. Jeans are one of the major perks of self-employment as far as he's concerned. Pete Huntley calls as he's heading out the door to inform his old partner that Oliver Madden is in custody. Hodges congratulates Pete on the collar and has just settled behind the wheel of his Prius when his phone rings again. This time it's Holly.
Where are you, Bill?
Hodges looks at his watch and sees it's somehow gotten all the way to 3:15. How the time flies when you're having fun, he thinks. My house, just leaving for the office.
What are you doing there?
Stopped for a shower, didn't want to offend your delicate olfactories. And I didn't forget about Barbara, I'll call as soon as I...
You won't have to. She's here, with a little chum named Tina. They came in a taxi.
A taxi? Ordinarily, kids don't even think of taxis. Maybe whatever Barbara wants to discuss is a little more serious than he believed.
Yes, I put them in your office.
Holly lowers her voice.
Barbara's just worried, but the other one acts scared to death. I think she's in some kind of jam. You should get here as soon as you can, Bill.
Roger that.
Please hurry. You know I'm not good with strong emotions. I'm working on that with my therapist, but right now I'm just not.
On my way. There in 20.
Should I go across the street and get them Cokes?
I don't know. The light at the bottom of the hill turns yellow. Hodges puts on speed and scoots through it. Use your judgment.
But I have so little.
Holly mourns, and before he can reply, she tells him again to hurry and hangs up. 14. While Bill Hodges was explaining the facts of life to the dazed Oliver Madden and Drew Halliday was settling into his Eggs Benedict, Pete Saubers was in the nurse's office at Northfield High, pleading a migraine headache and asking to be dismissed from afternoon classes. The nurse wrote the slip with no hesitation because Pete is one of the good ones. Honor roll, lots of school activities, although no sports, near perfect attendance. Also, he looked like someone suffering a migraine. His face was far too pale, and there were dark circles under his eyes. She asked if he needed a ride home. No, Pete said. I'll take the bus. She offered him Advil. It's all she's allowed to dispense for headaches. But he shook his head, telling her he had special pills for migraines. He forgot to bring one that day, but said he'd take one as soon as he got home. He felt okay about this story because he really did have a headache, just not the physical kind. His headache was Andrew Halliday, and one of his mother's Zomig tablets, she's the migraine sufferer in the family, wouldn't cure it. Pete knew he had to take care of that himself. 15. He has no intention of taking the bus. The next one won't be along for half an hour, and he can be on Sycamore Street in 15 minutes if he runs. And he will, because this Thursday afternoon is all he has. His mother and father are at work and won't be home until at least 4. Tina won't be home at all. She says she has been invited to spend a couple of nights with her old friend Barbara Robinson on Teaberry Lane, but Pete thinks she might actually have invited herself. If so, it probably means his sister hasn't given up her hopes of attending Chapel Ridge. Pete thinks he might still be able to help her with that, but only if this afternoon goes perfectly. That's a very big if, but he has to do something. If he doesn't, he'll go crazy. He's lost weight since foolishly making the acquaintance of Andrew Halliday. The acne of his early teens is enjoying a return engagement, and of course there are those dark circles under his eyes. He's been sleeping badly, and what sleep he's managed has been haunted by bad dreams. After awakening from these, often curled in a fetal position, pajamas damp with sweat,
Pete has lain awake trying to think his way out of the trap he's in.
He genuinely forgot the class officer's retreat, and when Mrs. Gibson, the chaperone, reminded him of it yesterday, it shocked his brain into a higher gear. That was after period 5 French, and before he got to his calculus class, only 2 doors down, he has the rough outline of a plan in his head. It partly depends on an old red wagon, and even more on a certain set of keys. Once out of sight of the school, Pete calls Andrew Halliday Rare Editions, a number he wishes he did not have on speed dial. He gets the answering machine, which at least saves him another arky barky. The message he leaves is a long one, and the machine cuts him off as he's finishing, but that's okay. If he can get those notebooks out of the house, the police will find nothing, search warrant or no search warrant. He's confident his parents will keep quiet about the mystery money, as they have all along. As Pete slips his cell back into the pocket of his chinos, a phrase from freshman Latin pops into his head. It's a scary one in any language, but it fits this situation perfectly. Alea jacta est. The die is cast. 16. Before going into his house, Pete ducks into the garage to make sure Tina's old Kettler wagon is still there. A lot of their stuff went in the yard sale they had before moving from their old house, but teens had made such a fuss about the Kettler with its old-fashioned wooden sides that their mother relented. At first, Pete doesn't see it and gets worried. Then he spots it in the corner and lets out a sigh of relief. He remembers teens trundling back and forth across the lawn with all their stuffed toys packed into it, Mrs. Beasley holding pride of place, of course, telling them that they were going on a knick-knick in the woods with devil ham sandwiches and ginger snap tooties for children who could behave. Those had been good days, before the lunatic driving the stolen Mercedes had changed everything. No more knick-knicks after that. Pete lets himself into the house and goes directly to his father's tiny home office. His heart is pounding furiously, because this is the crux of the matter. Things might go wrong even if he finds the keys he needs, but if he doesn't, this will be over before it gets started. He has no plan B. Although Tom Sauber's business mostly centers on real estate search, finding likely properties that are for sale or might come up for sale, and passing these prospects on to small companies and independent operators, he has begun creeping back into primary sales again, albeit in a small way, and only here on the north side. That didn't amount to much in 2012, but over the last couple of years, he's bagged several decent commissions and has an exclusive on a dozen properties in the Tree Streets neighborhood. One of these, the irony wasn't lost on any of them, is 49 Elm Street, the house that had belonged to Deborah Hartsfield and her son Brady, the so-called Mercedes killer. "I may be a while selling that one," Dad said one night at dinner, then actually laughed. A cork board is mounted on the wall to the left of his father's computer. The keys to the various properties he's currently agenting are thumbtacked to it, each on its own ring. Pete scans the board anxiously, sees what he wants, what he needs, and punches the air with a fist. The label on this key ring reads, Birch Street Rec.
"Unlikely I can move a brick elephant like that," Tom Sauber said at another family dinner. "But if I do, we can kiss this place goodbye and move back to the land of the hot tub and BMW, which is what he always calls the West Side." Pete shoves the keys to the wreck into his pocket along with his cell phone, then pelts upstairs and gets the suitcases he used when he brought the notebooks to the house. This time, he wants them for short-term transport only. He climbs the pull-down ladder to the attic and loads in the notebooks, treating them with care even in his haste. He lugs the suitcases down to the second floor one by one, unloads the notebooks onto his bed, returns the suitcases to his parents' closet, and then races downstairs all the way to the cellar. He's sweating freely from his exertions and probably smells like the monkey house at the zoo, but there will be no time to shower until later. He ought to change his shirt, though. He has a Key Club polo that will be perfect for what comes next. Key Club is always doing community service shit. His mother keeps a good supply of empty cartons in the cellar. P
Pete grabs two of the bigger ones and goes back upstairs, first detouring into his father's office again to grab a Sharpie. "Remember to put that back when you return the keys," he cautions himself. "Remember to put everything back." He packs the notebooks into the cartons, all but the six he still hopes to sell to Andrew Halliday, and folds down the lids. He uses the Sharpie to print "Kitchen Supplies" on each in big capital letters. He looks at his watch. Doing okay for time, as long as Halliday doesn't listen to his message and blow the whistle on him, that is. Pete doesn't believe that's likely, but it isn't out of the question either. This is unknown territory. Before leaving his bedroom, he hides the six remaining notebooks behind the loose baseboard in his closet. There's just enough room, and if all goes well, they won't be there long. He carries the cartons out to the garage and puts them in Tina's old wagon. He starts down the driveway, remembers he forgot to change into the Key Club polo shirt, and pelts back up the stairs again. As he's pulling it over his head, a cold realization hits him. He left the notebooks sitting in the driveway. They are worth a huge amount of money, and there they are, out in broad daylight where anyone could come along and take them. "Idiot," he scolds himself. "Idiot, idiot, fucking idiot." Pete sprints back downstairs, the new shirt already sweat-stuck to his back. The wagon is there. Of course it is. Who would bother stealing boxes marked "kitchen supplies"? Duh. But it was still a stupid thing to do. Some people will steal anything that's not nailed down, and it raises a valid question. How many other stupid things is he doing? He thinks, "I never should have gotten into this. I should have called the police and turned in the money and the notebooks as soon as I found them." But because he has the uncomfortable habit of being honest with himself, most of the time at least, he knows that if he had it all to do over again, he would probably do most of it the same way, because his parents had been on the verge of breaking up, and he loved them too much not to at least try to prevent that. And it worked, he thinks. The bonehead move was not quitting while I was ahead. But too late now.